Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 11 of Film Club with Casper, the podcast where I recommend a film, or my guest rather recommends a film to me, it depends, and then you guys get a couple of weeks or so to watch the film and then listen to the podcast where we talk about it. And this week we're doing American Honey by Andrea Arnold, her film from 2016. And my guest today is Catherine Angel, who teaches English and Creative Studies. Is that right?
Yeah, more or less.
Sorry, you just told me and I fucked it. And who is the author, among other books, of Unmastered, Daddy Issues. And you have a forthcoming book, right?
Yeah, and that one's called Tomorrow's Sex Will Be Good Again.
Right. And are you sure? Can you promise me that?
No, sorry.
Oh God. I mean, it can't get worse. Thank you so much for being on the show, Catherine.
Pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So what made you pick this film? Because I know that it was pretty much the first one you thought of when we were talking about it.
Yeah, I just really love Andrea Arnold, and I suppose I've seen some of her films several times, and I'd only seen this one once. I haven't seen everything, but you know, some of them I know better than others, and this was one that I'd seen a few years ago.
Yeah.
And had found really intriguing, and I guess I had maybe slightly mixed feelings about it.
Yeah.
I felt like I want to rewatch it in a more kind of mindful, intentional, sort of attentive way. And I want to talk about it with somebody, and I thought it'd be really fun to talk about it with you.
I think it will be. I'm really excited to talk about it. I think perhaps I should just skim over what plot there is, because it's quite a loose film in many ways for the listeners. But so it centers on a young woman, barely a woman of 18, I think, called Star, who gets involved with a bunch of people of her age or a little more, who are sort of going around the country, the below the Mason-Dixon line in the US, and selling magazines door to door and getting high and basically handing over a part of their fee to their boss, who's played by Riley Keough and who's called Crystal. And she gets involved with the de facto leader of the gang called Jake, who's played by Shia LaBeouf. And that's basically it, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. It's very... it's very road trippy, because they're driving in a van, a whole bunch of them, just along these highways and stopping off at various towns. And Crystal, the kind of leader of the outfit, and Crystal and Jake drive kind of separately in a swanky car while the rest of them are in this white van. And so, yeah, it's meandering, and there are parts that kind of capture the aimless, stuffy boredom of driving, I guess. Someone like my favourite moments in the film are when they're just in the van and they're singing along to music, or they're arguing, or they're flirting, or they're
just talking shit.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah. I think I couldn't agree more. Those were the scenes that really caught my attention, especially because Andrea Arnold kind of takes her cue from those scenes and from how easygoing and naturalistic they are, and that, you know, her camera placement and how close she is to these people, all of that editing is just so delightful, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because when you and I were emailing about what film to watch, and we thought about American Honey, and I can't remember if you said, like, oh God, I don't know if I like that film, or you said something like about sort of not being sure if you thought it was good or something. So I'm really curious to hear what you think about it.
Well, so it's just that I've had so many kind of different and differing opinions on it. I think the thing that people dislike about it is, I guess, that it's brash and vulgar, and it kind of underlines what it's doing a lot. You know, I mean, you couldn't accuse the film of any great subtlety in either its metaphor or its, you know, its means. But I don't know. I think the more I think about it, the more I kind of I go along with what's being done here. You know, the extended kind of music video aesthetic, the discussion of money that's so kind of on the nose, the view of America that's sort of at once romantic and kind of obviously critical. I don't know, there's a lot here that's sort of it's that feels really naive.
And what would you like? I'm just interviewing you now.
But yeah, I don't know. Do you see what I mean? That I don't know. How do you feel about that? The form of it, and how kind of on the nose it is.
I mean, I don't know. It's interesting. I can sort of see what you mean in terms of that critique. But it's funny because one of the things I really love about it that might be to do with what I love about her other films as well is actually what I think is a really subtle and like quite stubbornly complex view of women, not just women, but I'm kind of very interested in how she represents young women, teenage girls, young mothers, you know, women who are kind of very determined to exert the power that they do have, often in very kind of limited and constrained circumstances. And I think what she does with kind of personhood is really extraordinary, but it's quite opaque. And I think that's why I think it's subtle, because in so many of her films you get what I think is a, and I don't know if it's at all conscious in her way of working. I suspect it's probably not, but what do I know? I feel like she kind of steadfastly, like right into her marrow, refuses a way of looking at people's behavior, and perhaps especially women's behavior, that invites a sort of, you know, very easy kind of hierarchy, or invites audiences to rule on whether a woman has made bad choices or whether we should condone her behavior or condemn it. And that way of understanding how people behave is just so deeply sidestepped in her films, and that I think is kind of rare. And I think it means that these women are given this kind of portrait that is so gorgeous, and it's so much kinder, as well as being very kind of clear-sighted about the conditions in which people live their lives. And I think in this film, what I find really interesting is that some of that work is done through the character of Jake, because there's that, you know, that really interesting moment where, so Jake is kind of, you know, he answers to Crystal, and Crystal, played by Riley, I never know how to pronounce her surname, Rio?
I don't either. I've started saying Keo, but I don't know.
So she is just an amazing performer, I think. And she, in this film, she exudes this kind of really steely power. And she's kind of quite scary in a way. And I think she's able to do that as an actor, because she's so good at this kind of impassivity, or this kind of unreadability. So she exerts this, you know, this real power over these young kids who go out and sell these magazine subscriptions and then bring back the money to her, and she hands them out stuff for, you know, bits of food and drink, I guess. And there's this amazing scene where, after there's kind of tension that has emerged between Star, the young girl who you know, the film kind of centers around, between her and Crystal. Crystal kind of asserts her dominance over Star by giving her a bollocking about something, probably not earning enough money that day, while getting Jake to apply fake tan to her.
Yeah.
And so Crystal is standing there, and she's, you know, she's this kind of really gorgeous, statuesque woman. She's standing there in a Confederate flag bikini. And I think there's stuff in the film about America and America's history that maybe we can touch on. And she's standing there and kind of bossing Jake around, and he's literally massaging fake tan into her thighs and her bum and her legs.
Exactly. He's sort of getting higher and higher with his hands, isn't he?
Yeah.
The scene is,
you know, assertion of sort of power dynamics.
Yeah.
But it's really complex because on the one hand, you know, Star seems to feel jealous because she and Jake have been getting it on. And on the other hand, it's also like a potentially humiliating moment for Jake, because Crystal is also showing both Jake and Star that she has the power over him.
Mm.
And that he's kind of performing some sort of service to her. And then there's the issue of the fact that Crystal tells Star later on in the film that she pays Jake girl money, essentially money to kind of recruit women into the gang. And so that I found really interesting because I think that it's also about, you know, I think it's a film that's about class, and it's also about like sexual labor and how Jake as a man also has to perform kind of sexual work in order to survive and in order to kind of get by and to, you know, keep juggling this really precarious life. And I think it's quite rare to see that done so well, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a quite extraordinary scene where Star makes money from some guy who wants to spend an evening with her, and then wants her to jerk him off, and then in his truck. And I feel like that scene is sort of juxtaposed with the first sex scene between Star and Jake, which is sort of filmed quite tenderly, but then he takes her money immediately afterwards, the money that she has earned. And by kind of being in that sexual relationship with her, he asserts his power to take her money. And I feel like there's sort of a parallel in those two sex scenes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's a lot of transactions in the film.
Yeah.
And people often owe something to someone else, and the money kind of keeps circulating. And in fact, one of the moments I thought was really interesting was there's a scene where, what happens is they drive, and then they stop off in some town or some city, and then they all kind of radiate out to try and sell magazines to people's homes. And sometimes it's like very, you know, wealthy areas, and sometimes they're really kind of down at heel areas. But so they go off in various directions. They kind of scatter. And there's one scene where they're at a truck stop, and Star manages to get one of the truck drivers kind of potentially interested in buying magazines, and he gives her a lift. They drive off. And I remember when I first watched it, I thought, oh God, something really bad is going to happen here.
Yeah.
But what happens is that they just kind of talk, and they listen to the radio, and then there's that Bruce Springsteen cover of Dream Baby Dream, and they sing along. And then he does, I think, buy some magazines, and then he drops her off at the slaughterhouse where he was delivering cows. And in the film, there's lots of kind of like moments where animals kind of come into view, and one of the gang adopts a dog And animals often feature in her films in these kind of peripheral but quite interesting ways. Mm. And suddenly this really shocking moment where she's standing, Star is standing in a field after he's dropped her off, and she realises that she's got blood on her feet and the ground is covered in blood. And so they're right near the slaughterhouse. And I didn't quite understand this scene. I didn't know whether there was like a slaughtered animal somewhere nearby, or whether, like, I mean, I felt like it was as if the ground was kind of, there was blood seeping up from the ground or something, you know. So she's disgusted and she kind of steps away and she's going, because her feet are, you know, covered in blood and gunk. And I found that scene really interesting because I felt like, you know, you've got these kids who are like, they're vulnerable, they're alone. Like when Crystal sort of interviews Star, when Jake introduces her into the gang, the interview basically consists in Crystal just like looking Star up and down and saying, is anyone going to miss you? And Star says no. And then Crystal says, okay, you're in.
Yes.
And so there's always hovering this fact that these kids are kind of, they're alone. They're on the run from something, or they've got nothing to lose. They're kind of a bit wild. They're sort
they're
of feral,
aren't they, in the sense?
Yeah. And it's really kind of painful. And there are moments when you feel like, oh, this is when the really bad thing is going to happen.
Mm.
And in the scene, I found it just really powerful because nothing bad happens. But then at the end, there's this kind of horrible reminder of you know, death and violence and slaughter. And I mean, I don't know, I could go on about that. Maybe we can talk about, because, you know, there's that amazing moment when they're in the van and they talk kind of squeamishly and sort of excitedly about this case where some men raped and murdered a woman along one of these highways.
Yeah.
And go to a Walmart and buy a shovel and they bury her and then they return the shovel to the Walmart.
Yeah.
And they tell this story and they burst out laughing and they're like, oh, that's so gross. But it's a spectre in the whole film of like, this is a place of kind of anonymity and freedom and lawlessness, but it's a place of danger. Like they could be, you know, they could sort of fall off the ends of the earth and no one would know.
Okay. Mm.
So there's this kind of wild energy to it that is about the constant sort of spectre of violence.
Yeah.
I think she does a lot in her films.
It's the old Chris Christopherson lyric, isn't it? Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose.
Yeah.
You know, they're out on the road. But you're right, I think there's that... I think that spectre of death planing over the whole film is really powerful. And it kind of gives... A strange aura to all of these proceedings, to everything that's happening, and there's a sense of danger, and it's very strange when the film is in the end so mild.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of that scene, the quite strange scene where she goes off with those three men with their, you know, cowboy hats, or what are the, you know, word is half gallon, or I've forgotten the word for those hats, and who are sort of rednecky, because it's worth mentioning also that she's a woman of colour.
Mm.
And perhaps we can come on to that as well. But there again, danger is sort of averted, really. It's only when Jake comes thrashing into the scene that there's any kind of conflict at all.
Yeah.
There's something, I don't know, it's kind of weird. And I was thinking about it in terms of The Wizard of Oz, because there are lots of references in the film to The Wizard of Oz.
Oh my goodness, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I don't mean lots of, but, you know, they're in and around Kansas. Mm. And she's off on this journey with these strange people, and, you know, the idea of far from home. I rewatched The Wizard of Oz recently because Well, I'd like to be writing something about Judy Garland, but lockdown has robbed me of any concentration. So I'm actually not writing anything about Judy Garland at the moment, but I would like to be. Mm-hmm. And and I rewatched The Wizard of Oz, and what's extraordinary is how terrified Dorothy is at all times. I mean, it's extraordinary. She's just this, it's a girl just screaming in fear from beginning to end, practically. And I feel like, as you were saying, Star is sort of in control somehow of her environment.
Yeah, she's very, she's quite fearless, and she's very determined. And she takes a lot of risks, I mean, as they all do, because they sort of have no other choice, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, it's interesting what you're saying about The Wizard of Oz, because I was thinking about this amazing piece of writing I read recently by a writer called Vanessa Veselka.
Right.
That's her name.
Yeah.
And it was about her kind of teenage years, where she was basically on the road hitchhiking across America, you know, as a teenage girl. And it was partly about the fact that she had once been picked up by a truck driver who turned very nasty and who threatened to kill her, and from whom she managed to escape. And then years later, read about a serial killer who had eventually been jailed, and who she was convinced was this guy that she had hitched a ride with. And so she became obsessed with trying to find out if it was him. And she did all this research into the numbers of women who are killed along interstates in America, along the highways. And she wrote this amazing article about the kind of road narrative and the absence of women within the road narrative. And she talks about how kind of narratives about the road for women are completely overdetermined by death and rape, basically. And that it's partly that there is no narrative for women in those kind of spaces, that that women figure as kind of you know, outside of space, as having been shunned or having been cast out, as opposed to, you know, being on a sort of solitary heroic quest. And she makes the case that sort of narrative fact is also what contributes to women's, to the murder of women and to their invisibility once they're murdered. Because she talks about how, you know, even though she had heard lots of stories in the places she was hitchhiking about dead women, there were never any kind of like official records anywhere. Or these, you know, these women completely disappeared from view. And I just, when I was watching American Honey, I thought about that a lot, because, you know, it is a dangerous space for all these kids, and they're so young. And there's, you know, and as you mentioned, she's a woman of color. We don't know much about her past. That at one point she says something about her mother being a meth addict and having died. But that's also in the context of Jake kind of teaching her how to tell a story to get people in their houses to sort of take pity and want to give them money. So I remain unsure as to what we actually know about Star's background.
Yeah.
But one of the kids, I think, there's a very kind of slight reference to the fact that one of the kids in the gang is gay.
Yeah.
And makes some sort of poignant, grim joke at some point about, you know, whether he's going to survive this town. So there's just this kind of very matter of fact acceptance of their vulnerability throughout the whole
thing. I'm really taken with this idea, because I was thinking about, I wrote a complete, you know, there's a completely nonsense you know, ill-informed article about this a few years back, where I was just talking about the country music that I love, and country music comes up in this film. And the country music, in country music, there is that that divide that you were talking about. You know, the men are on the road, the Waylon Jenningses and all of that lot, who called themselves the highwaymen, or, you know, outlaws. are all off travelling down the road, and then and female country singers traditionally sang about the home, you know, about being at home with their mother or that sort of thing. And there's a real divide, I think, between being out in the world and being kind of stuck, or for want of a better word, you know, held back in that domestic sphere. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something, there's also a racial component there, because the idea of sort of disrespecting the law and of the man as an outlaw is all about sort of owning the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the white man particularly exerting his own dominion over the country. And this film, which incorporates country music, is set in the antebellum South, and is talking about all of those things, really.
Mm. Yeah, and there's that very, I mean, the soundtrack is really interesting because there's a lot of hip hop and then there's country music, and the song, there's that song American Honey by, is it Lady A?
Well, that's right. So they've changed their name now, but they were Lady Antebellum.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, they changed their name. It's incredible. So I wanted to come on to it, but it is incredible because they changed their name about 2 or 3 weeks ago, barely, in the wake of, you know, Black Lives Matter protests, etc. And they, along with the Dixie Chicks, who are now the Chicks, have changed their name.
Oh, wow, that's really fascinating. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's that amazing moment when... I think there are two sentences that Jake says, like, at both ends of the film that I think are really interesting. So when he meets Star in a supermarket, and then he tries to kind of persuade her to join the crew, there's something he says... you know, he explains what they do, and then he says, "Oh yeah, we do more than work. We explore America and we party." And I thought that was quite fascinating because it's like a really neat description of what they do. You know, they go to this really like smart suburban area where you know, a white woman and her teenage daughter let them in. And the teenage daughter is kind of dancing very sexily to some hip hop. And Jake is quite distracted by this. But he's also trying to sort of play up to the mother and play the role of the kind of thwarted college. You know, the kid who wants to go to college but is trying to make money to go to college. And she sort of patronizes him. She laughs when he says he wants to study politics, I think. And it's really outraged on his behalf and sort of fucks the whole transaction up because she refuses to sort of play the game. And then, you know, the flip side is they go to some really kind of destitute parts of America and see some really grinding poverty. So, you know, they really see America and they party. Like, they really party. They have these wild nights where they kind of fight and they fuck and they get completely high and they're like dancing around bonfires and stuff. And then at the end of the film, when like him and Star have had sex a few times, and then she goes and has that sort of weird encounter with the guy on the oil field that you mentioned, where he jerks off and he gives her $1,000, and she comes back with this money to kind of give to Jake because he had spoken so that they could kind of, you know, sharing this money together, because he had said to her, "All I want is 40 acres and a mule," when he's talking about wanting to like just build his own home and have a little farm, or, you know, sort of settle and kind of have a more stable life. And I was struck by that phrase because that's part of the whole American Civil War kind of land battles, I think. It's sort of what was agreed on in terms of what people could, in terms of what people were offered on the basis of the land that they had worked on. And so he's expressing this kind of, you know, I suppose deep American sort of history of like you know, frontier chasing and becoming the kind of master of the land that you've sort of penetrated.
Yeah, it's just the fantasy from Of Mice and Men all over again, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just thinking, you know, that scene that you were talking about where they, that you were just mentioning, where they go and see the well-to-do woman and her daughter's kind of whatever, dancing to Ray Sremmurd in her yard. And that just sort of reminded me of a kind of thread that did the rounds on Twitter a few days ago or a few weeks ago, which was talking about things that sort of are things that are posh when rich people do them and, you know, lower class when when poor people do them. Mm-hmm. And obviously dancing to, you know, like it was interesting to me that the her daughter's frames of reference and tastes are the same as this group of as this group of door-to-door salespeople. They're listening to the same songs, you know.
Yeah, that's true. And
so I think the film says a lot about America there as well through the music that it soundtracks itself with. Mm-hmm. What did you think of the sex in the film? Because I don't know, I'd been told that that the second sex scene between Star and Jake when they fuck in the grass was, you know, one of the all timers. And there was something sort of horny there and sort of real, you know, they were actually talking about sex while doing it, and there was an acknowledgement of pleasure and you know, there were good details because she takes her tampon out before they have sex. So there was a lot going on, and the camera's right up close.
Mm.
But I also thought that it was sort of, that it kind of overly romanticizes the sex between them as well, and was sort of a bit fairy tale-ish.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I found it striking that there are two, is it two scenes? There's one when they're in a car.
Yeah.
After Jake has sort of kind of rescued her from these cowboys who were actually not doing anything wrong. And they steal their car and drive off. And they have sex in the car. And I remember that being very, very sort of sparkly, like there's a lot of play with the light and they're in some lay-by or something, but it's very, there's a lot of green, there's plants and and that happens again in the scene nearer the end when they're in the grass, and there's a lot of like shimmering light, and it's quite beautiful. I mean, I was struck in that second scene when the camera is really close to them on the ground, it's sort of near their heads. There were a couple of moments when the camera moves back quite suddenly, and I felt suddenly really aware of her camera work. And but then I was actually talking with my partner about this just recently, because he's a big fan of Andre Arnold as well, and he was talking about how people have written a lot about her, this kind of creaturely element to her films, that the film work is often as if there's a sort of almost like an animal companion next to the characters, or just behind them, or kind of at their heels or at their shoulders, like a sort of a gaze that is sort of close but not like stalky, that's more like companionable. And I really felt that in that scene, in that sex scene, where it was almost like an animal that is near them while they're having sex and then suddenly gets a bit too close and sort of backs off. So I find it quite beautiful, but I know what you mean. I mean, I felt like partly she was trying to, I guess, draw a contrast between the sort of, you know, the road and this stuffy van and the kind of the grime and the sweat and these horrible pokey motel rooms and the sort of lack of open space and lack of privacy, but they're so on top of one another. And then in the grass, in these kind of snatched moments of privacy, there is something quite magical about it.
And I think maybe she's internalizing Star's perspective as well, so giving us you know, her subjectivity and in her viewpoint of Jake, who's on top of her and kind of enfolding her and almost sort of blotting her out in that scene where they're so hunched together. So I don't know, there's some interesting stuff there. I was just sort of hoping, I guess I'd been led to hope for sort of just a bit more, you know, and for the camera to linger with them as well in the kind of aftermath.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, I mean, it's also quite abrupt, like those scenes end and then, you know, when they go back to the gang and he says, oh, give me the money because I've got to give it to Crystal because we're late. We missed the drop-off and I've got to grease the wheels because otherwise she'll be really pissed off. And Star is like, fuck, I earned that money. Why am I giving it to you? And then he says, oh, there's something like love and business don't mix. He was like, we're not in a relationship.
Yeah.
And as you say, I think, yeah, there is something about the, like, the point of view kind of is her sort of, you know, her ups and downs, her moments of kind of, you know, delight and hope and wishfulness about, you know, something better, and then kind of crashing back down to a scene where it's loser's night and the two people who have earned the least money have a physical fight that's kind of choreographed by Crystal. And so you kind of come crashing back down to this very, like, you know, quite brutal, exploitative situation in which these people's kind of physical and emotional and sexual labor is being ruthlessly used by Crystal.
Mm. Yeah. And in that scene, there's a sort of Lord of the Flies quality, you know, where these people who have been existing in kind of companionship together are finally set upon one another by dint of their desperation, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then there's a really weird scene where Crystal... Star asks to kiss the winner of the fight. I was intrigued by that, and I'm not sure. I don't know if it quite fits the tone of the film. I think she's trying to make Jake jealous, and exert a little bit more power over him. And perhaps there's something to do with, you know, the power of the men in that instance. I don't know, I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
Yeah, you're right that doesn't quite fit, I think. Because it's as if that's a more easy trope, I think.
Right, yeah.
Of, like, competition or jealousy. Because there are moments when there are kind of questions of sort of sexual jealousy, like when Star sort of realises that there's a new girl, and Crystal, that's when Crystal says to her, you know, I give Jake girl money and he fucks them all. Or the scene when with the fake tan, there is an issue of sort of rivalry between women for the attention of Jake. But I think mostly it's more complex than that, and Arnold kind of overlays it with these kind of intersecting questions of class and, you know, all the complex transactional logic between all these individuals, because they are all having to survive in this really kind of rickety, unsteady world. And I agree that with that scene, when it looks like she's just trying to make Jake jealous, it's sort of, it seems too simple somehow.
Exactly. That's what I was getting at, I suppose. It just sort of didn't feel of a piece with the rest. One thing that struck me And I guess we've touched on it a little bit when we were talking about Lady A, who were Lady Antebellum until 3 weeks ago, is that this film was made 4 years ago, and yet it feels sort of almost to me of another time, because it was made pre-Donald Trump, and Trump gets a shout out early on in the film when Jake says they're talking about his trousers, and he says, "Well, what's wrong with my pants? Do you think they're a bit Donald Trumpy?" And so I looked it up, and the film was made around the time Donald Trump announced his candidacy for the presidential election. But obviously at that point, he was nowhere near being the Republican nominee. And the film came out in 2016, before he became president. It's really interesting to me that it's citing its depiction of, all of the things you're mentioning, poverty and class struggle and even gender representation within this battled over Deep South.
Mm.
And 4 years on, all of this could scarcely be more potent.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I feel like how films, they really stand the test of time.
Mm.
I mean, I've watched Fish Tank quite a few times, and I feel like that it really bears rewatching, and it's sort of, I mean, they're interesting because they're films that are often really based in a particular place, like Fish Tank and the shorts that she did, Milk and Wasp.
Mm.
They're really of that particular area of, the sort of Kent, Essex.
Mm-hmm. And Wuthering Heights as well is so sort of...
Described. And so maybe there's something about... there's something about really rooting a visual landscape so intensely in a particular place that can sort of transcend political political in a kind of organizational sense, transcend those kinds of shifts. Because, yeah, I sort of agree that in some sense, American Honey is, like, if she were making that film now, it would presumably be quite different. And yet at the same time, it's about poverty, and it's about escape, and it's about mums who can't look after their children, and it's about families that are kind of, riven by addiction and all the fallout of that.
Mm.
And of course that's been with us forever and continues to be exacerbated every year. So I find them interesting because they're so particular, but they're also quite expansive.
Yeah. It's interesting that I hadn't really thought about your point at all, actually, before you mentioned it, about the geographical particularity. But it's interesting that Jake is always pretending to be somebody else when they go door to door, and he presents himself as being from all over the country, and is kind of, I think, changing his accent according to whoever they're talking to, and perhaps even haphazardly as a game for himself. And that comes after everybody else has introduced themselves in the van to Star and said where they were from. They're from Florida, they're from all sorts of places. And Jake is from, I don't think we find out where. Then Kansas is held up as this kind of sort of unreal or imagined place.
Mm. Yeah, when they drive in and they're kind of amazed by the tall buildings and
the railway lines.
What, you know, who lives in those, what the hell are those buildings? And yeah, that scene is interesting because I remember both times I watched the film, that scene quite early on when she's introduced to the group and they all go around and there's like, I don't know, 15 of them or something, and they each do their little thing or they introduce one another. And I found it actually kind of intensely awkward, that scene, and I thought, oh, this isn't working, this film it's not working. Like, I found it really awkward.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking to myself about her casting methods, because, you know, in lots of her films she goes out and finds people who are not trained actors, and she literally just like takes them off the streets. Yeah. I mean, not forcibly. But I heard her talking in an interview about this, how she casts, and I found it really kind of troubling in a way, because I think what's fascinating about American Honey and also some of her other films is they have this kind of wild energy to them. Like, there's something slightly chaotic about a lot of the performances where you feel that things are kind of constantly on the edge of falling apart. Like, it feels like there's a real risk being taken. And I heard her talk about how basically, so Star, I've forgotten the name of the actor who plays Star.
Saoirse Lane.
Yeah. So she, I think, Andriano found her at, on spring break, like,
right. Yeah.
In some place, maybe in Florida, where they all go on spring break. I can't remember. I don't know enough about American culture. But she talks about going to these places, going to shopping malls, or just hanging out in these kind of hot spots of partying at spring break, and just watching these kids and sort of approaching them. And she talked about the ways in which they, you know, try to make it like not kind of predatory and you know, professional, and like, you know, not pushing people into doing something they're not comfortable with, and, you know, giving them information, but then saying, like, you know, we'll be doing auditions all week at the Walmart parking lot. Mm. Come along. Mm. And I was really struck by how similar that was to the dynamics of the MAG crews in the film, which was based, you know, on this New York Times investigative story that Andrea Arnold had read about these, you know, these kids in these MAG crews, and basically this crazy unregulated industry that was rife with violence and corruption and, you know, like serious kind of horrible stuff. And then I was thinking about that scene where Jake kind of spots Star, and she spots him, you know, because she finds him attractive and she's intrigued by the energy of these kids in this van.
Yes.
And there's kind of like dance between them, and they approach one another. And but then I was thinking how similar it is to Andrea Arnold's casting methods, and how, you know, just like this space of kind of possibility and anonymity and kind of unruly potential of the road that she is filming in American Honey, that's exactly the spaces that she goes into to find these kids who maybe themselves have nothing to lose, you know, like the kids in the MAG crews. Maybe some of the kids she approaches for her films might be similarly, you know, is there someone who is going to miss them? I mean, I found myself really intrigued and kind of a bit disconcerted by the kind of, like, you know, the potential for sort of dodginess or like subtle coercion or kind of dangling something in front of some kid, you know, doesn't
movies.
Yeah. Like, it's rife for exploitation, I suppose. It's ripe for exploitation. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I think that's what gives some of her films this incredible energy, is you've got these people who end up in them, you know, some of them who turn out to be extraordinary performers. And 10 minutes before they started making this film, they were like, you know, they were a single mum on a council estate struggling to find somebody to look after their kids while they went on a date with some guy who got out of the army. I mean, the parallel, you know.
Yeah.
I find it really... like, you can really see that texture in the fabric of the films themselves.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point. I love it. I think there's something, just to carry on and on that idea of the sort of metatextual quality of, you know, Andrea Arnold's filmmaking and, you know, the process there. You know, when we were talking about women not being on the road, it's also interesting that she's a woman on the road and she has set herself that challenge almost of doing, of, you know, making this road movie and making something that's really punk and young and that isn't the kind of her expected province.
Yeah, and she's had a very interesting kind of career. Like, what I remember, I looked it up recently, and didn't she start? She had like a good sort of 10-year career as a TV presenter, like a kids TV presenter.
Yeah, she was on Blue Peter.
Oh my God, that's amazing. When she was like young.
Yeah.
Like young, and then went to film school, and then started making films. And I mean, like she seems to have some kind of like resourcefulness and grit and steeliness that that a lot of the characters in her films have. And I find it very kind of interesting the way you often, and she had a kid quite young, I think. And a lot of the women in her films are juggling sex and parenting. So in Fish Tank, you have the mother of the young girl who is the one who has the boyfriend played by
Michael Fassbender.
Michael Fassbender, who ends up sleeping with the daughter.
Yeah.
And the mother is, you know, she's probably like 30 or something, and she's got these two kids, and everything is a little bit chaotic, and she is kind of trying to get on with her life and, you know, have love and sex and romance and dealing with, you know, a surly teenager. And there's a lot of that kind of the proximity of motherhood and sex that I think is really interesting and really rare. And usually when it's represented, it's done in incredibly sneering and judgmental tones. And in fact, I remember reading an article, like an academic article, about Andrea Arnold and about Fish Tank that talked really disapprovingly about the main character's slutty mother who was having sex in the house where, you know, she was raising these young girls. And I thought, fuck you. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on your podcast.
You definitely are.
I mean, I was absolutely apoplectic reading that.
Yeah.
Misogynistic. You know, these films are partly about women who are often literally left holding the baby and they have their own thwarted pleasures and desires and ambitions. And, you know, and in American Honey, the film starts with Star and two little children who she's looking after who are not hers, scrabbling around in bins trying to find some food.
Mm.
And she ends up leaving those kids who aren't hers and giving them back to their mother who doesn't want to look after them because she herself is being kind of sexually abused by the kid's father. And then off she goes on the road to try and, you know, escape this grim situation.
Yeah. The film reminded me, in those early scenes, I thought it was going to be much more in the vein of something like, have you seen The Florida Project?
Oh, no, I haven't, but I was quite keen to see that. I don't know why I didn't.
It's a pretty incredible film, but I think in retrospect, it sits in judgment on the single mother that's at the heart of the story and kind of is critical of her for her sex life. She resorts to sex work to bring up her young daughter and is eventually carted off by social services for being a bad mother. There's a very clear difference in the approaches there, and yet both films are sort of presenting things in quite an upbeat way, and they have these sort of candy colours and a kind of innocence at their heart, which is quite intriguing.
Yeah, there's a kind of playfulness, or like the representation of those. There's a lot of parking lot scenes in American Honey where they're outside the motel and you know, it's kind of grimy and grim and there's all this traffic, but they're kind of they're partying. They're like, and it, yeah, and it is, it's sort of double-edged. Like, is that romanticizing some of it? I don't think it is, but
yeah.
I think it's sort of partly a film about trying to get some pleasure where you can.
One thing I just wanted to mention really quickly, I don't think there's a great deal to be said about it necessarily, but I was struck in this film by how much of a movie star Shia LaBeouf is in that role of Jake. And I think, you know, there again, there's something sort of a bit metatextual of him being the legit big actor who's going along with some amateurs and, you know, and Sasha Lane in her first movie role. And the way he kind of sort of blends in, but also very much stands out as this charismatic figure is really interesting. And I think the film is really loving towards him in many ways.
Yeah, that is fascinating, actually, because, yeah, in the film, he sort of takes Sasha, Star under his wing and teaches he tries to teach her the spiel and the shtick of how to, and he says that amazing thing. He says, you have to figure out what kind of person this person wants in their life, and then you have to be that person. So that's the advice he gives her about how to get people to give you money, but it doesn't work at all in her case. But so he's sort of teaching her how to act. You're right, there is a really interesting meta-textual kind of narrative going on there. And I think, I mean, I've only seen him in this and in Nymphomaniac. And I think he is absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think in this he is stellar. Like, he is really extraordinary. But I haven't seen him in any other things. And I get this vague sense of him as somebody that people find very easy to mock or to deride. And I don't quite know why, but you know the way you get that feeling from the ether. And so I don't really know if that's the case, but I thought he was absolutely stunning.
Well, he was always sort of acting up and being a bad boy and turning up to premieres with a paper bag on his head and doing that sort of shit. And I think he was a figure of fun for the internet for a long time. But his film Honey Boy that he wrote and which came out last year, it's quite interesting in some ways, and it's autobiographical and gives a sense of him as a child actor and having always been a star, supporting his father in lowly circumstances. There's quite a lot there that's really interesting and that is interesting when you think about his role in this film as well.
Yeah. I haven't seen that. I will watch.
Yeah, it's not a totally brilliant film, but he's pretty good in it, and the kid who plays him as a young boy is sensationally good. Were there any closing comments that you wanted to make, things that you think we haven't touched on? So I feel we ought to probably wrap up in the next five or so.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there was just one thing that I thought was interesting about Andrea Arnold in general. Was I heard an interview with her and Terry Gross from, is it the New York Times?
Yeah.
And it was a really funny interview because basically Andrea Arnold was quite resistant to a lot of the questions that Terry Gross was posing her. So Terry Gross was trying to say to her, like, so what was your childhood like? You know, you're very interested in teenage girls and, you know, young women and sexuality and poverty. And Andrea Arnold just sort of refuses to be drawn. And she just says, like, I don't do that. I don't talk about my own life. And Terry Gross tries to get her to sort of, you know, draw the links between herself and the film, and also to sort of draw out, you know, what the films mean, or, you know, why is she so powerfully attached to the figure of the teenage girl. And Andrea Arnold says this really interesting and I think really important thing, where she says, I think it's really important for the kind of the mystery at the heart of a film to remain available to a viewer to experience. And I don't want to unpack that and tell everybody what it's about or what this scene means or why I wrote this, because that's not my place to do. You know, my contribution is the film, and then the viewers have to experience it. And I found really, I mean, it makes for a difficult interview, and you could tell Terry Gross was like, oh, for God's sake, what can I ask? You know, what are you going to ask? But I found it really refreshing and kind of quite inspiring to hear, you know, an artist just sort of really draw that boundary and say, there are things I'm not going to talk about. And also, that there's something about the integrity of a piece of art that has to be preserved. And it's not my place to kind of unfold every little tuck and, you know, shine this kind of very bright light on it. And I thought, good for you. Good for you for being like a difficult interviewee.
Yeah. Do you think that's a gendered, in some ways a gendered question about, you know, bringing your personality into your work and explicating for other people what it might be about?
Possibly, yeah. Although I do think, I mean, it's just a very powerful urge that the culture has, I think, to say to somebody, you know, what inspired you and is this based on your own life? And, you know, I'm sure men get it too, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it may be more something that women artists get subjected to a little bit more. But yeah, I really respect that kind of commitment to the art itself, you know. And it is quite rare to see people do that because it's very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable.
Right. Well, I'll look it up. Terry Gross and Andrea Arnold. And actually, yeah. I should say that if listeners want to read another good article on which touches on this Lady Antebellum stuff a little bit, there's a really good piece by Amanda Petrusic in the New Yorker about the Dixie Chicks changing their name, so they're now the Chicks, and that's just a really lovely, tight, informed article about, you know, the progression of country music and the idea of quote unquote Dixie. That's worth checking out. All right, I might wrap up there if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and that was fascinating.
Pleasure. It was really fun to talk about it with you.